7. Hot lights, real tears. I struggled a bit in elementary school. I'd rate myself academically as having been barely average. I later figured out, when my own kids were having some difficulties here and there, that I had what would today be diagnosed as learning disabilities. Mrs. Barton proved a boon in this respect. I responded well to one-on-one tutoring. But in the 1960s, my public school teacher's diagnosis was pretty much, well, he's a C student, but at least he's well-behaved. I flailed sometimes. Cursive, for example, did not come easily to me. But do you know what kicked me into gear to figure it out once and for all? Having to sign autographs. Near the end of the Andy Griffith Show's first season, TV Guide convened a bunch of child and teen stars to pose for a photo shoot in the swimming pool of the Grand Roosevelt Hotel on Hollywood Boulevard, across the street from Grauman's Chinese Theater. There were about 20 of us in total in our bathing suits. I waited near the front, in the shallow end. Jay North was also there, along with Rusty Hamer and Angela Cartwright from The Danny Thomas Show, John Provost from Lassie, and for sex appeal, some older actors like the twins Dak and Dirk Rambo, who were starring on the new Loretta Young show, and Donna Douglas, who played Ellie Mae Clampett on the Beverly Hillbillies. The term teen was used loosely. The Rambos were in their early 20s, and Douglas was around 30. This was my first taste of Hollywood glamour and the perks and perils it held. I'd never experienced the excitement of fans, gawkers, and paparazzi calling out our names. But it was daunting to have kids thrusting pieces of paper and pens at me, asking for my signature. Johnny Crawford, who played Chuck Connors' boy Mark, confidently obliged everyone who wanted his autograph, which made sense. He was in his mid-teens. But I was still in first grade. I was sweating it out self-consciously, doing my best to sign my name for a fan in my slow, rudimentary scrawl, R-O. When he grew impatient and just ripped the piece of paper right out of my hands, "There's the beef," he said, making a beeline for Jerry Mathers, who was 6 years older than me and consequently could write a whole lot faster. I thought, this is too embarrassing. I gotta figure out this handwriting stuff. As it happened, I didn't attend regular school at all in first grade. It was studio school all the way. With the first season of Andy's show coming to an end, my newfound fame presented an opportunity. Warner Brothers was adapting the 1957 Broadway hit The Music Man by Meredith Willson, and they needed a little boy to play Winthrop Peru, the lisping, much younger brother of the female lead, Shirley Jones's Marion Peru. I don't think I auditioned. The Andy Griffith Show essentially served that purpose. But my father left the choice of whether or not to take the part to me. Dad explained that the movie would shoot while the Andy Griffith Show was on hiatus, when I was supposed to resume my schooling at Stevenson Elementary School. It would mean sacrificing the few months when I would get to live like a normal kid. "You don't have to do this if you don't want to, Ronnie," Dad said. "With the Andy Griffith Show, it's different. That's a 7-year contract. That means that if the show keeps going, you have to do it. But you don't have to do other things." I was torn. I was looking forward to returning to Stevenson, where I had spent kindergarten. Though we now lived in Hollywood, my parents had wangled permission for me to stay in the Burbank school system. But I could tell that Dad wanted me to say yes. He knew it was a rare opportunity, and he clearly had a bullish attitude about the movie's prospects, telling me, "This is a really good script, it's from a successful Broadway musical, and there'll be other kids in the cast." I really mulled it. In fact, it's the only time in my childhood where I took my time and thought through the question of, do I really want to do this? Having seen Dad sit waiting by the phone for days, I already understood that as an actor, you take what you can get while the getting's good. But I was on the fence. I wanted to go to school and play with other kids. Ultimately, I agreed to do The Music Man, a little bit more out of respect for Dad than for any career-building purpose. At that point, I still didn't really understand what a career was. Nor did I think that what I was doing on TV and movie sets had any bearing on something as serious as my future. But I sure am glad that I said yes. The experience proved to be a once-in-a-lifetime adventure, and for me, a new frontier in entertainment making, creative energy, and clockwork professionalism. Andy Griffith was excited for me, too. He had been approached by Meredith Willson about playing the male lead, Professor Harold Hill, in the original Broadway production. He paid a visit to Willson's house, where the composer and his wife performed the whole show at the piano. Andy said it was one of the most mesmerizing performances that he ever witnessed. But Andy withdrew from consideration. Though he had serious theater chops and a genuine musicality, he felt he lacked the slickness and dance skills to pull off the role persuasively. The part of Harold Hill went to Robert Preston, its rightful owner then, now, and forever. And now Preston was about to bring his signature role to life on the big screen. This being a big-budget studio picture, the studio invested some time and money in preparing me to learn how to sing, a good move, since I had inherited the Harold Beckenholt gene for being hopeless at carrying a tune. And Winthrop had two big musical spotlights, singing a verse of the Wells Fargo Wagon and his very own song, Gary, Indiana. While I was still finishing up the first season of The Andy Griffith Show, I was required to begin side sessions with a voice teacher named Mrs. Weber. She was something out of 1940s Hollywood, an olive oil thin woman with her own baroquely decorated bungalow on the Warner's lot. Frizzy cat lady hair, oversized glasses, big wide eyes augmented by elaborate press-on lashes, and bright red lipstick that never quite covered up the cracks in her lips. And the patience of a saint. I did not take to singing easily. There was a lot of repetition, a lot of, "Let's try that again, Ronnie," as Mrs. Weber pounded out the notes on the piano ad nauseum, waiting for me to absorb the melody and rhythm of Gary, Indiana. Concurrently, my dad was teaching me how to do Winthrop's lisp. I wasn't aware of what a lisp was when I took the part. Dad explained without judgment. Some people have a speech impediment where the letter S comes out as a TH sound. We worked it out methodically, line by line in the script, so much so that I can still recite from memory Winthrop's exclamation when he receives his prized cornet. "Thista, thista! I never thought I'd ever see anything so strumptuous as this thumps you a solid gold thing. Oh, sister." Translation? "Sister, sister, I never thought I'd ever see anything so scrumptious as this scrumptious solid gold thing. Oh, sister." And it wasn't just a lisp. On certain S's, for comic effect, I also had to turn the sibilant sound into a spit-spraying raspberry. For example, the little kicker to that speech went, "Oh, sister." There were also raspberries built into my songs, "If You'd Like to Have a Logical Explanation" in Gary, Indiana, and "Something Special Just for Me" in the Wells Fargo Wagon. This was a lot to absorb, but Mrs. Weber kept drilling and drilling me until we finally arrived at a reasonably in-tune, rhythmically acceptable version of Gary, Indiana. The next step was to pre-record the song in a studio. Once the cameras were rolling, I would lip-sync to this recording. The recording session took place on the large scoring stage at Warner Brothers. The major studio still employed in-house orchestras, and I arrived to find about 80 musicians sitting behind their music stands, attired not in formal wear but in casual clothes, smoking cigarettes, filling out crossword puzzles, and reading the trades. That is, until Ray Heindorf, the movie's music supervisor, arrived and tapped his baton on his stand. On cue, the musician sat up straight, poised to begin. This was a few years before the development of sophisticated multi-track recording technology, so I sang live with an orchestra. Me, Ronnie Howard, live with an orchestra like I was Frank Sinatra or Ella Fitzgerald. Except I was the furthest thing from them. After 5 or 6 takes, I could feel some tension emanating from Mr. Heindorf. A Warner Brothers lifer who had been in the business since the advent of the talkies, he had worked with Eddie Cantor, Jimmy Cagney, and Judy Garland. Now he was trying to get his orchestra to play in rhythm with a 7-year-old kid who, while doing his darndest to nail the pitch and a fake lisp, had no innate gift for keeping time. Mr. Heindorf conferred with Mrs. Weber, who coached me as best she could. We did a few more takes, but it still wasn't working. Then Mr. Heindorf hit upon an idea. He handed me his baton, positioning it in my fingers so I was holding it the correct way. An assistant brought out a box for me to stand on. "Now, Ronnie, you direct the orchestra while you sing," Mr. Heindorf said. So we tried that. The musicians were palpably exasperated, staring at me quizzically while barely hanging on, and I think that Mr. Heindorf was backseat conducting them from where he stood a few steps behind me. One way or another, we arrived at a take that was usable, and that's what you hear in the movie. I suspect that the powers that be, Meredith Wilson and the director Morton DaCosta, decided that my determined, if off-key, attempts to hit those high notes, not Louisiana, Paris, France, New York, or Rome, were, if nothing else, kind of adorable. Still, my troubles with this number were not over. My first day on the set was the day that Morton DaCosta was shooting Gary, Indiana, on the front porch of the Peru house. Shirley Jones and me, along with Pert Kelton as our mother. Pert was wonderful, by the way, a stout, comically shrewd lady who, like Bob Preston, had been in the Music Man's original Broadway cast. The problem was that I was supposed to do a little soft shoe at the end of the song in time with the music, a cute little tippity-tap that ended with a pirouette. As has been previously established, I got no rhythm. Poor Mrs. Weber was also charged with getting me to master my dance steps. We practiced for hours. Both of us, in tap shoes. I wasn't going to be wearing tap shoes in the movie, but this way I could hear my steps as I took them, which provided confirmation of whether I was on or off the beat. We thought we had the routine down, but before we shot the scene, Morton DaCosta asked us to do a rehearsal run. Mrs. Weber was there, as was Anna White, the choreographer. Despite their gentle encouragement, I kept messing up. After a couple of tries, I heard DaCosta sigh and tell the camera operator, "Dolly in and cut him at the knees." Having weathered a season of series television, I knew not to be alarmed by such a turn of a phrase. DaCosta only meant that they were going to frame out my feet. With a hint of exasperation, he told me, "Just turn around in a circle at the end and we'll put the steps in with the sound." Anna then swooped in to teach me the shortcut. In the film, you only see me from the knees up. But thanks to some movie magic, specifically some toe-tapping sounds that were added by the Foley artists in post-production, it appears that I'm totally crushing it as a child hoofer. I don't want to make it sound like The Music Man was a harrowing experience. I loved being a part of something so brilliant, ambitious, and festive. There were discomforts, sure. They dyed my already very red hair even redder so that it would pop in Technicolor, and that coloring process actually burns the scalp a little. They made me wear period wool stockings under my shorts, which were held up by a garter belt that itched like a son of a bitch. And it was punishingly hot under those Technicolor-friendly lights. The crew kept giving the cast these iced, mentholated little chamois towels to apply to our necks so that we wouldn't faint. But I was thrilled to participate in a big, old-fashioned Hollywood backlot musical and to watch the huge ensemble numbers come together. For Shapoopy, the song that Buddy Hackett sings, they hoisted the camera to the very top of the soundstage so they could get those Busby Berkeley-style overhead shots of the chorus line dancers forming a circle and doing the can-can. The budding director in me took mental notes. Dad did his usual prep work with me prior to filming so that I had a good handle on my character and the plot. He read the whole script to me aloud. He explained that Professor Harold Hill isn't really a bad man, though he is up to no good at the beginning. Because the Wells Fargo wagon number was such a centerpiece of the movie, he gave me a little rundown of how commerce was practiced in the days of yore. When I was a boy, there was no Sears store to go to and no Albin's toy store, he said, referring to my favorite shopping destination in Burbank. No, you had to send away for things you wanted to purchase. He reminisced about how he and his parents circled items that they wanted in a thick Sears catalog, and when they had saved enough money, they ordered these items by mail. And when these things arrived, they arrived by truck, and his parents had to leave the farm and pick them up in town. This is like that, but even longer ago, Dad said. So for these townspeople, it's like Christmas morning when the Wells Fargo wagon comes. This explained Winthrop's pent-up excitement over taking delivery of his cornet and his thithter thithter speech. I still have that horn, by the way, and can still just barely play the minuet in G on it. Morton DaCosta noticed how effective my father was in preparing me and offered Dad a part as one of the townspeople. It wasn't something that Dad had been angling for, but the powers that be recognized that having him around was good for me. He shows up in lots of shots in The Music Man if you keep an eye out for him.
I want to note how emotionally honest and uncute Ron's performance was. Ron is cute, but not his acting. You see Winthrop go from a shy boy who's inhibited by a speech impediment to a kid so confident that he's firing finger guns at Shirley Jones and Pert Kelton to give them their cues. Props to Dad for helping Ron internalize that journey.
I returned to the Andy Griffith Show with a spring in my step, and I could sense that Andy, Sheldon, and Aaron were proud of me. I was proud of having earned some acting stripes somewhere else, and in a major motion picture, no less. When my 8th birthday rolled around that season, the producers surprised me with a giant cake and a sing-along of Happy Birthday. It was also Aaron's birthday. He was exactly 40 years older than me, so we shared the cake. Planted in the icing was a little figure of Aaron holding a megaphone and another one of me holding a fishing pole. They served me the first slice, and it looked better than it tasted. Privately, I craved my mother's devil's food cake with chocolate icing. She later admitted to me that she had made hers from a Betty Crocker mix straight out of the box. But hey, my mom made it, and no chocolate cake has ever tasted better to me. I had never had a birthday party before. Our peripatetic family life to that point had precluded it. My most memorable birthday to this point had been my 4th, when we still lived in Queens. My parents took me to FAO Schwartz in Manhattan and let me choose a gift. It was an easy call. A Zorro set, complete with a mask, a flat-brimmed gaucho hat, and a plastic fencing foil. I actually wore this outfit to my first Broadway show, a matinee performance of the Little Abner musical, based on the comic strip. I was bored and didn't really get it. It was apt that Andy would later disparage the play. For this latest birthday, celebrated on set, Andy and Aaron gave me a Bell & Howell Zoomatic 8mm movie camera, my very first. Aaron told me that I could now make my own movies. For the next 8 years or so, that camera spent most of its time sitting idle in its brown leather case. But it was eventually put to vigorous use, and even before then, my mentor's encouragement boosted my self-confidence. Years later, when for the first time I was nominated for a Directors Guild Award for Cocoon, Aaron and Sheldon attended the ceremony. I didn't win, Steven Spielberg did for The Color Purple, but I sought out Aaron to remind him of his gift. I did not take for granted that this was a rare opportunity to thank a childhood benefactor for planting the seeds of my happy, productive adult life decades earlier. Armed with my newfound confidence that second season, I started watching TV and movies differently. Dad took me to a screening of the original 1931 version of The Champ, the King Vidor boxing picture that starred Wallace Beery in the title role and Jackie Cooper as his son. Cooper was incredible. I couldn't get over how believable he was in the movie's final scene when his father is dead and all the grown-ups are trying to console him. His face alone does incredibly complicated work, mustering a range of faint smiles to oblige his consolers, but not masking his actual state of profound grief. Cooper's performance, along with my newly accumulated movie experience, triggered my competitive juices. When I watched a kid actor on a TV show, I evaluated his performance and compared it to what I was doing on Andy Griffith. I took inventory of my contemporaries, Johnny Crawford on The Rifleman, Jay North on Dennis the Menace, John Provost on Lassie, the Leave It to Beaver guys, the My Three Sons guys. I concluded that, in terms of acting prowess, I was second only to Johnny Crawford. Jay North I respected as more or less an equal. The rest? In my cocky state, I concluded that they weren't on my level. Johnny brought a truthfulness to his performance, an honesty that seemed lived in. The actors on Leave It to Beaver, which began in 1957, were hamstrung by how dated their format was. The show struck me as corny, synthetic TV that encouraged a forced, mannered brand of acting. At this point, I realized that acting was more than an exercise in pleasing adults. It was my job. From The Journey through The Music Man, I had regarded work as an elaborate form of playtime. Now, I paid closer attention to Andy and Don and understood that acting was, for them, a way of life, a career, and that the longevity of their careers depended on the quality and consistency of their performance. That was a thing Andy said all the time while we worked on the show. It's not good enough. I'm not good enough. Let's make this better, funnier. He always pushed for excellence. Ergo, I did too. There's a fine line between confidence and arrogance, and I crossed it in the Andy Griffith Show's third season. We were shooting an episode entitled Andy Discovers America, whose script was by John Whedon, the patriarch of a screenwriting family that includes his son, Tom, who wrote for Captain Kangaroo and the Golden Girls, and his grandson, Joss, of Avengers and Buffy the Vampire Slayer fame. To Andy Griffith fans, this episode is noteworthy because it introduced Anita Corso as Helen Crump, the schoolteacher who had become Andy's girlfriend and later his wife. But for me, this episode was a big deal because it included some classroom scenes in which Opie and his pals tested the patience of Miss Crump. This meant I'd have company at Desilu Kawanga for the week. Keith Thibodeau as my sidekick, Johnny Paul Jason, along with, among others, the child actors Dennis Rush and Joey Scott. As the relative veteran among this crew of Moppets, I felt like showing off. This was my hit show, my set. I took on the role of ringleader, strutting around like I owned the place, goofing off and telling jokes right up until the camera assistant clapped the slate. In other words, I let things go to my head and forgot about the process, the discipline, and the etiquette of the set. I must have been hard to control that day because Dad took me aside to remind me to concentrate, something he hadn't needed to do since the first season. But hey, I was feeling my oats, and even my father wasn't going to put me in my place. I continued to act the wise ass, wriggling in my desk chair, firing paper airplanes into the air, and showing off for a couple of the girls sitting next to me in the scene. Then, between takes, Bob Sweeney, the director, took me aside, an uncharacteristically serious expression on his face. Very quietly and without any harshness, he said words that are still imprinted on my brain. "Ronnie, I know it's fun for you to have all these other kids around, and you want to make them laugh. But that's not what I want to talk to you about. Ronnie, you're a good young actor, but you still have a lot to learn. In fact, you aren't even the best young actor in this scene today." That honor he bestowed upon Dennis Rush, who was indeed doing a bang-up job. "It's not just that he's paying attention and behaving well, Ronnie," Bob said. "It's that he's really thinking about the scene. He is connecting." Bob had more to say. he noticed that I had been slipping into some sloppy acting habits, falling into the classic series regular trap of phoning it in. He urged me to bear down, to focus my attention on some small, real-life detail like the lint on my shirt or a chipped corner of my school desk, to put my mind in a place where I wasn't caught up in the lights and microphones, but rather grounded in Opie's reality. In short, Bob challenged me. I still feel a twinge of queasiness just thinking about this gentle but firm dressing down. Bob was right. I was falling into bad habits, such as reciting my lines in a lazy sing-song way instead of linking them to the real ideas that the words in the script conveyed. One reason that so many child actors fail to evolve into adult professionals is that under pressure, they default to a perky autopilot, an artificial cuteness that some directors are willing to settle for. Left alone, these kids never grow as actors, and they reach their young adulthood unable to react, improvise, make spontaneous discoveries, or develop multiple approaches to their scene work. And then one day, they're no longer little and no longer adorable, and they have never really learned how to act. The business is done with them. I pulled it together for Miss Crump's debut episode, and Bob told me that I performed acceptably, if not superbly. He saved me that day from sliding further into bad habits, and arguably from becoming a toxic Hollywood brat, forevermore resting on laurels earned in short pants. I don't recall any other director ever having to crack the whip in my direction again. Later on, in the 1970s, when I had the chance to work with some of the greats from Hollywood's golden age, acting with John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, and Henry Fonda, and directing Betty Davis in a TV movie, I saw firsthand what separated them from the lower ranks. A remarkable work ethic and an unwillingness to brook substandard work, whether their own or someone else's. I also had Dad. He set an example in two ways. First, he armed me with the fundamentals so that I had the tools with which to grow. Second, he kept hustling for parts in the face of constant rejection. His career struggles were a sobering reminder of just how rare a position I was in as a series regular. We were still living in Hollywood when Clint and I experienced our first tragic death. Gulliver, our beloved Weimaraner, somehow broke loose from our backyard one day and ran into the street, where he was struck by a car. We were all home. I heard a horrible yelp and ran out to the street, a few steps behind Dad. What I saw didn't seem real. My dog whimpering on the blacktop, his life draining out of him, his blood strangely dark and thick like motor oil. Dad cradled Gulliver and carried him into the house, still alive but fading fast. We Howards are not a particularly tearful family, but I lost it, sobbing as Gulliver breathed his last. This sad moment came to bear on my Mayberry work not long afterward. We began the fourth season in 1963 with an episode called Opie the Birdman. This was only about 6 months after my misbehavior during the Miss Crump episode, and a big test for me. The episode had two big emotional scenes for Opie. In the first, Opie is outside playing with a new slingshot he has made with Barney's help. Though Andy tells him to use it only to shoot stones at tin cans, Opie aims at a tree and accidentally kills a little songbird, which falls to the ground. At first, Opie tries to talk the bird, and really himself, into believing that what just happened isn't so bad. It's probably just a scratch, he says to the animal, which is lying still on the sidewalk. He picks the bird up and holds it in both hands, begging, "Fly away, please, fly away." But when he opens his hands and gives the bird a little upward push, the bird falls back to the ground like a lead weight. In tears, Opie backs away in horror and then runs into the house aghast at what he has done. The second big scene is in the episode's resolution. Andy gives Opie the responsibility of raising the bird's orphaned chicks in a cage until they are capable of flying. At that point, Opie must let them fly free and rejoin nature, even though he has grown close to his little flock. For that scene, I thought of Jackie Cooper, layering conflicting emotions one on top of the other. And I was good. But the scene where I realized that I have killed a mother bird required something more, an authentic portrayal of guilt, fear, and grief. I couldn't have described the challenge in those words, but Dad did his best to prepare me the night before the shoot, explaining the depth of Opie's feelings. Still, I went to sleep worrying and wondering, how was I going to find those feelings? I was still searching for the answer to this question the next day, even after we rehearsed the scene and the camera was positioned. Then Dad took me aside. "Do you remember how you felt when Gulliver died?" he said. "That's the way Opie is feeling now. That feeling of being scared and sad and disappointed. Think about that." Richard Crenna, who directed that episode, must have noticed that I was in an intense emotional headspace because he called out his usually robust action in a hushed, somber tone. They rolled camera, and as I picked up that prop bird and implored it to live, I thought of Gulliver. For the first time as an actor, I cried real tears and trembled real trembles. I'd come a long way from my subpar display of emotion in The New Housekeeper when Sheldon Leonard intimated that he might have to spank a performance out of me. When Dick Crenna yelled, "Cut," I was still in my methody sad zone, but the mood around me was one of euphoria. Everyone had just watched me ascend to a new level. From every angle, big adult hands extended toward me to shake mine or tousle my hair or pat me on the back in congratulation. Foremost among my congratulators was Andy. I told him what I'd been thinking about as I was doing the scene and broke into tears all over again. He gave me an empathetic hug and then gently reminded me that it was time to rehearse the next scene. We were on a schedule, after all. I was on a roll that year. Vincent Minnelli cast me in his film, The Courtship of Eddie's Father, adapted from a novel about a boy who tries to play matchmaker for his widower dad. I played Eddie, Glenn Ford played the father, and Shirley Jones reunited with me to play the divorcee nurse next door who ultimately turns out to be the ideal fit for Glenn's character. Though the movie was later adapted into a lighthearted sitcom, our version was more melodramatic. I consider my performance in this picture to be the best of my childhood career. Eddie has a scene in which he discovers a dead goldfish floating in his tank and shrieks in fear. Shirley's character correctly intuits that Eddie has conflated the fish with his mother and comforts him as he breaks down. Once again, I summoned memories of Gulliver in order to place myself in my character's frame of mind, convulsing with grief, discovering emotional depths I was hitherto unaware of. MGM, the studio that produced the movie, was so impressed by my work that they considered mounting a Best Supporting Actor campaign for me. That didn't happen, but my confidence skyrocketed further. Minnelli fostered an atmosphere of comfort on the set by seeing to it that I had a babysitter and a playmate, his 17-year-old daughter, Liza. We passed the time between my scenes with a deck of cards, Liza teaching me all manner of sleight-of-hand tricks that I can still do today. Hanging out with the Minnellis was cool, but cooler still was recognizing my great leap forward. In Opie the Birdman and The Courtship of Eddie's Father, I had extended a part of myself into my performances. I had gone deep. I was no longer a child actor. I was an actor, period.